Welcome to this week's Classic and Contemporary Short Stories program. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. The first story is from The Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. Voice of the Town by Curtis Harnack. Theodore Ruff took on his life as if it held no mystery he couldn't solve. He tithed his income and served as elder in the Protestant church, sang the gaunt, sad hymns from his usual spot on the aisle in the fifth pew. Even God seemed taken care of. But behind this amiable show of certitude, we saw the looming figure of his youngest son, Danny, who by age 15 was 7 feet 2 inches tall. As he began to sprout, Clara Ruff joshed with her friends about what a big boy she had produced. They squinted behind their smiles and let her think what she wanted. Theodore was put to the trouble of buying special shoes and clothes in the city, but all he talked about was what a swell basketball player Danny would become. Years later, Danny's surprising marriage to Levon seemed to fulfill his father's hope of a normal life for his son, hopes which we of the town knew Danny could never possibly realize. All the time Danny and Levon lived and worked together, we saw their alliance with our own eyes, but groped for an important truth lurking somewhere in their privacy. Who would tell of it? Theodore never cracked. He was Kahlberg's leading banker, keeper of the public confidence, and no one ever knew what torments of doubt or unease afflicted him. Finally, he was to go to the grave clean and fast with a heart attack before any audible whimpers could begin or any revelations. Because of men like Ted Ruff, the general faith is held or deeply doubted. One wonders why anybody'd like to see himself in such a dubious role, and why we always expect someone to play it. The Ruffs was a third house in from the highway as you entered town, green clapboard with steeply pitched eaves and 100 running feet of porch, all of it screened. There on card party evenings, Ted Ruff was the smiling host, clearly visible through the windows to passers-by and automobiles, as if he were on display. At the party, everyone talked a great deal, but mostly about the tricks just taken and who should have trumped but hadn't. The poor, rough children, according to custom, were kept out of the way. But Danny, the giant, dazzled by the company, would climb like Jack and the Beanstalk up into those rooms of people from the basement playroom. "What were you doing in the cellar, big fellow?" a guest might call. "Lifting the house? Hey, how's the weather up there?" This from one of Clara's twinkly friends. He never answered. Even his face was peculiarly unresponsive. His round jowls simply hung there like a peeled eggplant. "Danny, you get your sleep," Clara said in her soft sigh way. "Go on now, you're the youngest," an excuse she used to hide the fact that sometimes he got so tired he fell asleep standing up or sitting in a chair and had to be caught before he hit the floor and broke his flesh open. He couldn't bear the cold in winter like the others. He fainted from the heat if he went out in August without his blue baseball cap. Germs found a haven in his huge interior, and nothing could stop their proliferation, as if inside not all the caverns had yet been accounted for. Claire was like the hen that sat on a deck egg along with her own, and she refused to see a difference among her offspring. She was very bosomy, such an enormous pillow that it seemed ample not only for the Ruff family to cushion its fears upon, but also for anyone who might need this reassurance. In winter she draped herself in a fox-collared coat, soft as a dog shank. Her creamy pearls, a double strand, for years the only real pearls in town, stood for the things which were not of flesh, and she believed in them. While he was young, Danny moved along from grade to grade, but at the start of high school the principal had a closed-door talk with Ted Ruff. Soon Danny showed up as a clerk in his father's bank. "Hey there, big boy," customers called. "Got your hands on the money yet?" Cheerful as always, and now even somewhat handsome in a blown-up way, he'd grin and wave his baseball mitt hand. But he never said much. "He understands real good," said the teller. "He's taking it all in," said the cashier. "He'll be a banker yet," said Ted Ruff, thinking he was among friends, but it soon got around town. Danny performed simple clerical errands, such as going into the vault with a customer's safe deposit key. He swept the floor and kept the cooler filled with water. Try as he might, he couldn't learn to work with figures. He found it hard to concentrate, sitting at a desk, his spine curved like a wishbone. Ted had new furniture built, but Danny still couldn't remember the multiplication table. "What do they teach in that school?" Theodore shouted one day, and a farmer at the grilled window overheard and passed it along. "What do they teach? What do they teach? Was savored in taverns and stores all week. To think Ted Ruff hadn't been taught the difference between a soft head and a normal person. Danny was dismissed on orders from someone higher up, and for a time not even the family seemed to pay much attention to him. The two older boys were busy suiting up for basketball after school. They dribbled down the glistening floor with the cocky good feeling of being loose in the joints. Girlfriends tumbled to them quickly. They had no time to look after Danny, and even his sister ran out on the old tender responsibility. She became a cheerleader. Luckily, Danny's found something he likes to do, Clara announced, smiling imperturbable. He just loves cars. Although Danny couldn't pass the written driver's test, he knew how to operate them. He'd take the wheel whenever it was offered and barrel through the curves of the nearest winding road. Each hairpin turn and two-wheeled squealing corner seemed to thrill him into a skin-close consciousness otherwise unattainable. A couple of no-goods around town got a kick out of letting Danny loose on the highway. As he laughed aloud at the nearness of death, for a few vital seconds he did not feel buried alive in his body. The result was, however, he rolled a car over and was in the hospital half a year. "He's not the same," Clara said when Danny got out. "He's been affected," she told her card-playing crony, shaking her head, and they let her talk. At last she'd been given a respectable excuse. "He's got to learn a simple trade," said Ted, urging a farmer who was heavily in debt to the bank to take Danny on as a harvest worker. But it didn't work out. "The lummox," said the farmer. "He's always on the ground under the bundle wagon, sucking on a lemonade jug." In no time Danny was drifting around the pool halls, and one saw him drunk in the middle of the afternoon. Sometimes Theodore Ruff, in his neatly pressed blue suit, gold-flecked tie, shiny shoes, and snap-brim hat, walked right down the sidewalk past his sprawled, half-unconscious son, who was loafing on the bench in front of the bank. They wouldn't look at each other or speak. When the Korean War broke out, the two Ruff brothers, who were graduating from college, arrived home in their uniforms and made their last romantic impact upon the town. The one in Air Force blue with silver buttons, the other in ROTC Army officer's twill. One on each side of Clara, with Ted Ruff following behind, they walked down the church aisle under the eyes of God and the town. In the excitement, they forgot to include Danny, who awoke from a late sleep to find the house empty, the church bells ringing for the world, but not for him. He wept, and he was still weeping when the Ruffs gaily tromped back into the house. "Danny, Danny, don't be such a big baby," called Clara, one arm still around Army, the other looped to Air Force. "Hey there," both brothers cried out and leaped to Danny's side to pick up the easy old romp of their childhood. "Don't punch him," called Clara. "You know how easy he bruises." "Leave me alone! Just leave me alone!" Face still shiny with tears, he loomed up and entered the stairwell, mounting the steps carefully to his room, a giant on business. The family was stunned, almost offended by the discovery that Danny felt he had the right to his own emotions, which might not be theirs. He would not come down to dinner, nor could he be persuaded to tag along as the Ruffs bid farewell to their patriotic sons later that afternoon. "If they don't come back," Clara said finally, taking leave of him, the horns honking, "just think how bad you'll feel then." He looked at her angrily, stirring his huge limbs, and for the first time she felt afraid of him and fled the house. She didn't tell her husband what had made Danny so furious, only that "he looked about to hit me." "If it gets any worse," said Army, "you know what you'll have to do." "But we always said, your dad and I," Ted sitting right beside her in the back seat, "why have him put away when he's so harmless?" "Some of the women in town are starting to worry," said Air Force, who'd spent most of his leave getting reacquainted with high school loves. Both boys had already confided to their father that Danny was actually no threat on that score, since he was impotent. They were certain of it. Some years back, in an attempt to explain sex to him, they'd sat on a pasture gate and watched a pony stud in action. Much to their surprise, Danny wasn't the least interested. Now the rumors of his threat to the local girls was just the dirty country gossip one might expect, given his outsized proportions in that department, too. Every time he was caught taking a leak, there were guffaws and comments. But neither Ruff boy could bear to inform their father of the indecent nature of his talk, yet they felt some little warning should be voiced. The following week, Danny insisted he be allowed to enlist in the Navy. Theodore Ruff went through it all, helped Danny pack his bag, watched him bid farewell to his mom, and drove him to the Navy recruiting office above the city post office. He and Danny walked up the steps as if they truly expected to get somewhere. "My son here wants," Ted began apologetically, while the petty chief on duty, red-faced from sea winds, widened his eyes, pushed back his chair. "My son." "I came to enlist in the Navy," said Danny, his deep, half-muffled voice seeping out of the tower of himself. "I'm of age." A blush suffused his neck and lower cheeks as if the blood of his life were coming forth once he proclaimed himself a man. The 5'3" petty chief grinned and leaped to his feet. With a side wink to Ruff, he reached up and thumped Danny on the back. "More fellas like you and we'd win this war in no time." "Where do I go?" Danny twirled his little satchel nervously while Ruff blinked, looking embarrassed, and turned to gaze out of the windows. "Trouble is, you're so big you'd put the fleet to shame." "I'm too big?" "No, they're too small." He marched Danny into the examination room, laughing to leeward all the way. It was a slack day, and the medical officer was waiting. "Look what I've brought you." They took great pains to describe the narrow stacked seamen's bunks on a typical U.S. Navy vessel. They showed him skivvies and bell-bottoms so that he could see that none of them fit him. When the interview was over, they shook hands with Danny, called him a fine American, urged him to stop in and see them whenever he liked. "Well, son," said Theodore, "ready to go home now?" Danny nodded agreeably, but with a new independence. At last he'd gone beyond his father and the family's network in Kaleburg. He'd been seriously discussing his life with representatives of the United States government. All the way home, he couldn't keep the grin from his face. Then, through a pool hall friend, Danny got a job with a pinball machine company, Idle Hour Games. They helped him pass his driver's license exam and loaned him a car. His chief duty was to collect revenue from pinball machines and punch boards. Although they were illegal, most bars had several kinds of punch boards for the customer's amusement. You could buy a punch for a dime or a quarter, the whole card bringing the company 10 times the cash value of the prize for the lucky punch winner. Danny took a room in a small hotel in the city where he could receive messages that came while he was on the road. He collected coins from the pinball machines and learned to fix broken ones. Without his father close at his side, he managed to keep his accounts straight. After 3 months, he was courier for half a dozen shady operations, including a numbers pool, ball game pools, and a system whereby servicemen met girls. He was known and hailed as he made his rounds. Men would clap him on the shoulder and pump his soft hand, and Danny would bray with pleasure, showing his long-toothed, horsey grin. But suddenly Theodore Ruff received a call to bail Danny out of jail. He and the Idle Hour Games people had been arrested and charged with racketeering and procurement for the purposes of prostitution. An understanding judge commuted Danny's sentence, sending him home in the custody of his parents, who were henceforth to keep an eye on him. "We've been all alone here, Danny," Clara whimpered. "This big house and all the children gone but you." However, she couldn't make him her baby anymore. Before a week was out, he fled. They didn't know where he'd gone and were afraid to ask the authorities to hunt him up, since surely then he'd have to be put away. Both Ruffs became highly guarded on the subject, and while the addresses of the two boys in uniform and the girl in Los Angeles studying fashion were printed in the church bulletin, Danny was left out. Soon everyone read of Danny's marriage to Levon Zimmer before a justice of the peace in a town 40 miles away, one of those many villages where Danny had become known as a traveling man. Clara said it was wonderful to have somebody taking care of Danny. The Ruffs helped settle the newlyweds in a Kaleburg house available for $25 a month, provided Danny and Levon look in on the 80-year-old lady who lived alone next door, their landlady. Wedding presents arrived, but Clara gave no tea to introduce her daughter-in-law, and suggestions of a bridal shower were quashed for no reason, unless it was that Clara and Ted didn't want to pretend they expected grandchildren from this alliance. The old rumors about Danny's sexual abnormality began to surface. He wasn't interested in girls, everybody knew. So what was going on? Levon was tall and squarely built, as strong as Danny was weak. Her dark brown hair, the color of flaxseed, was done up in a coil over each ear, and flat spit curls just above her forehead were held in place by hairpins that seemed to staple her crown. She had deeply recessed small blue eyes and run-together eyebrows. Her mouth was a neat, thin line, and except for her nose, which projected a modest distance, she seemed almost bereft of the usual features that distinguish one of us from another. Everyone thought she was up to no good and had probably married the village idiot in order to cash in eventually on the rough money. Clara made a point of telling her friends that Levon had nursed her father through a long illness, that she was a good, shy, devoted soul, hard to get to know, but in every way worthy of her son. Levon didn't entertain in her home, nor did she accept any of the invitations to join women's clubs. "He's being looked after," said Clara joyously. "That's what counts." The life of the elder Ruffs separated easily and decisively from that of their son and his wife. Soon nobody thought to remark that it was odd Danny and Levon were never seen in the big green house on Main Street. It was increasingly hard to remember he was a Ruff at all. When the old drunk who ran the dray service got run over and killed by his own cart, Danny and Levon took over his business. They acquired a sorrel gelding used to plowing and corn planting and shod him for service on town streets. Levon showed the horse where to graze on the strips of pasture along the railroad embankment, and in the evenings he cleaned up the spilled oats and corn around the spouts of the farmer's elevator. The wagon was an ancient heavy box on four thick wheels. Panels slid into place, making a rectangle 4 feet deep, or the wagon could be stripped down like a railroad flat car. Originally there'd been a pair of horses for the outfit, but something had happened to one of them. Since the old man couldn't afford a new horse, he'd adjusted the rig. The load could be pulled from the whiffle trees by a single brute in harness. You may wonder what need there is for a dray service in a town as small as Kaleburg, since most citizens have cars and can make periodic trips to the dump with tin cans, glass, and junk that won't go into the backyard compost pile. But some people hate to run the risk of having their tires cut by broken glass or nails. They detest the sight of rats among the refuse, should they go there in daylight, or the bright little rat headlights gleaming all over the place at night. They call Danny's dray. Customers also phoned to have salvaged bricks hauled to the site of a foundation for a new house, or to carry lumber in a hurry when the normal delivery couldn't be made. Even the stores employed Danny and Levon to transport heavy merchandise. The price for service wasn't high, and thanks to Levon, the job was always done neatly and in good time without much fuss. In going about their business, Danny and Levon wore overalls and heavy work shoes, the leather so thick it didn't much matter what dropped on their toes. The only way to tell it was a man and a woman on the cart, not two men, was that Levon wore a babushka, except in the summer, when she was forced by the intense sun to wear a farmer's straw hat. Unlike junk carriers the world over, they never seemed interested in their burden or considered their freight in any light except that it was something to be disposed of. No little trinket was ever filched and kept in secret at home. When something of possible value was included in the load, Levon would speak about it to the person employing her. "That hairbrush?" the woman might reply. "Ach, its bristles are mostly broken. No, it ain't good for nothing but currying your horsey." And then Levon would use it for that as long as it lasted. She seemed to understand the dangers that might develop if she ever wised up to the business she was in. She was, in short, incorruptible, but the town believed nothing of the sort. They thought she ignored salvageable items because she was waiting for the rough fortune itself when the old folks died off. Meanwhile, Danny's dray made money, though they never seemed to spend any. Now and then they'd go to a movie, settle themselves in the front row where Danny had always sat, shared a nickel bag of popcorn, and watched the cowboys galloping across the screen. They put a dime or two in the collection plate when they attended church, which was infrequently. They didn't drink liquor or even beer because Levon said, what everybody knew, it didn't agree with Danny. Their car was a beat-up 1939 Chevrolet. Every morning Levon was first at the bakery for day-old bread. She kept a sizable garden and canned all summer. She knew what farmers could be approached about picking the tart plums in a forgotten lane to be made into preserves. The grocery supplies Levon bought were of the austere pioneer sort, flour, sugar, salt. Even the meat supply was arranged for privately during the country butchering time in February. The town speculated that perhaps Danny preferred the safety of his mattress or the sugar bowl for his hoard rather than his father's bank. Years later, the true tale leaked out in the surprising appropriate way these revelations occur. In the prosecution of one of Danny's pinball machine buddies, who'd been released after serving his term only to return to his rackets, the district attorney discovered that Danny Ruff had been paying hush money, sometimes amounting to $200 a month. The convict had terrorized him into believing he could be rearrested at any moment, and even Levon was convinced. Nowadays, some blame Theodore and Clara for not inquiring into the reason why Danny and Levon's back-breaking drudgery showed so little profit. But misery is often obscured because of the pride everyone takes in hard labor, the virtue it entails, the fact that work never hurt anybody. But it broke Danny, or rather the strain did. He was such a big, calm, plodding creature, no one thought he might be a mass of anguish inside. One day he got into the Chevy and drove to the state insane asylum 25 miles away to turn in. Levon was summoned for interview, and the authorities talked to Clara and Ted, each of them separately. Danny planned to remain safe inside the walls, Levon reported. He's real happy there. She spoke without bitterness or even resignation. Now I got to carry on with the dray alone, I guess. The town would have speculated at length about Danny's surprising action had not Clara succumbed to a stroke the same week. Her right side was paralyzed from top to bottom. She could only speak disjointedly with half a tongue, smile with half a mouth, and think with half a brain. It happened because of her grief over Danny's collapse. That's what people said. Levon immediately began to nurse her. In the morning, she'd go over to the house on Main and fix Theodore's breakfast before he walked to the bank, then lift Clara from her bed, carry her to the bathroom, wash her and dress her, and put her in the wheelchair. After a ramp was built over the front steps, Clara's trips in the mobile chair could be down the block or even the stores, Levon always in attendance. The dray service dwindled, but she still maintained the business. She continued to live in the little house next to the very old lady, now in her 90s, and checked each morning to see if the woman was alive. Clara was expected to regain use of her arm and leg. There seemed to be improvement for several months. But Clara enjoyed being taken care of by Levon and wasn't much interested in using the doctor's spring contraption to exercise her hand, biceps, and calf. She had no reason in particular to want to get up and walk again. "I've got it pretty easy, wheeling along," she'd say with a laugh. "I don't know as you folks have it so good." She would never be quite right in the head again. That was the trouble. There were no devices to fix that lesion. The doctor told Theodore that the end would most likely come suddenly one of these years with another series of strokes. Hard to tell just when. During this time, the three other rough children didn't come back. They had youngsters of their own, of course, which was fair excuse, but it seemed odd that in those 4 years none of them was able to make the trip home. Mostly it was thought the reason was guilt over Danny and shame that he was where he was, when the roughs could certainly afford a private sanitarium. But who would start doing something? Theodore washed his hands of it. He had enough to think about with Clara. His face and profile was pewter gray and stern, the look of George Washington on 25-cent pieces. The letters between the rough children flew back and forth from New York to California and Washington, guardedly speculating on what should be done about the home situation. But the last word was always, "Thank God for Levon." When Theodore died of a heart attack, all of them came back. What a strange procession they made, the children in the well-tailored dark clothes, walking behind the coffin, along with Dottie Clara, who was weeping, snuffling, and carrying on aloud, and sober, lean-faced Levon pushing the wheelchair down the church aisle, looking no more grim than usual. In fact, she was just the same as ever. She was about as tough as a mortal could be, in the best sense of the word, for no matter what was dished out, she took it without a whimper. She was not entirely of iron, however. A few weeks after Theodore's burial, when she moved into the house on Main Street in order to be closer at hand in ministering to Clara, she put her horse in the barn out back, which had been used as a garage. The city father said there was an ordinance against it. She received an official letter from the mayor warning her that she'd be fined if she didn't remove the animal. But she had to have him close by, not in the shed giving onto a pasture outside the city limits where she'd formerly kept him. She was wildly attached to the beast who'd been her companion all these years. She wouldn't give in. No, she'd pay the fine. But the penalty, it was explained, would be levied again next month and each succeeding month until she did something about complying with the city ordinance. Ladies who came to visit Clara got a full emotional report from the invalid, slightly off-key, a peculiar wheezing screech as if a half-melted phonograph record were being played on a faulty machine. She got Theodore's pistol out. Oh, yes, she found that, and she cleaned it up real good and dug up some bullets, too. Just you wait. Anybody comes trying to move her horse, you'll see some shooting, you will. Our property, ain't it? They can't do this to us. and after all we've done for this town. That kind of talk, bruited about the village, was just the sort of thing the high school hoodlums liked to take up. They deviled LaVonne as she walked the streets or drove her dray cart in the alleys. They cackled and hooted and even threw firecrackers, daring her to shoot the pistol. She never gave them the satisfaction of paying any attention. A special dispensation for the horse was finally granted in respect to the memory of Theodore Ruff. Everybody knew LaVonne had won because of her strange, fierce love for that animal. In farm country, you seldom hear of anyone getting affectionate over a cow or a pig or a workhorse because that sort of thing upsets the system. These beasts are in bondage to man. It's not the other way around. If only LaVonne had had the sense not to put that straw hat of Danny's on the creature, cutting out holes for his ears. If only the horse hadn't had such big blue eyes, which did indeed resemble Danny's. If the animal had been given some name like Nick or Dobbin. But he had no name, and so the high school kids began calling him Danny. Then you began to see other connections. The fact that he was a gelding, his lumbering gait and size, his sad, half-witted look. The effort LaVonne made protecting the horse got her into closer alliance, really a companionship. Cart, horse, and woman roamed the alleys even when there was nothing to be hauled, the cart empty. Some village gossip must have been written to the Ruff daughter in California describing the situation and saying that Clara was being neglected because of LaVonne's infatuation with the horse. A practical nurse was suddenly engaged to come and live in the house. LaVonne was no longer to attend the invalid. The stranger sent by a city agency was a hardy, gray-haired, meat-and-potato sort. She was righteously indignant over the filthy condition of the house, which apparently hadn't been cleaned for a couple of years. Moss had infected the clothes, mice and rats had the run of the basement and attic, and even poor dear Clara Ruff herself was so dirty on the back of the neck that she had to be scrubbed hard with a rough washcloth and strong laundry soap. Purveyor of all this juicy news, the practical nurse was welcome into every household on the block. She told more than she should have, or rather she kept repeating everything Clara said, and these ravings were increasingly unreliable and not to be listened to. For one thing, apparently LaVonne had been in the habit of caressing the old woman in those regions where one would imagine only the young feel intense pleasure. Clara liked to be handled gently, dreamily, and for a good long time until she went off to sleep. LaVonne, questioned about this by the practical nurse, who was shocked by such manipulations, was reported to have answered, "She'd smile and feel so good I never had to give her no sleeping pills. That's more than you've done for her." The remark, coupled with Clara's own peculiar notion about LaVonne, began to spread. The nurse quoted Clara as having said, "LaVonne's got whiskers like a man. A girl ain't supposed to have a chin like that. No, I don't think she's a girl at all." Actually, LaVonne had always carefully shaved the stubble she'd been afflicted with on her upper lip and chin. As these growths flourished in later years, she tried to cover them up with talcum powder. But one time Clara's hand had happened to reach out in a moment that might have been ecstasy, in the evening when the light was dimming in the bedroom and LaVonne was soothing the old lady for the night. She touched LaVonne's face, her eyes widening. Suddenly she thought she understood the mystery of this creature who'd come so accidentally into the Ruff household, and now was such an indispensable part of it. "Always in overalls she is. Works like a man. No wonder my poor Danny sent himself away." So when Clara died, and after the funeral and the dutiful visits from the far-off children, when the practical nurse lost her job and had to return to the city, in the settlement of the estate, the clapboard house on Main went to LaVonne, plus a small income from farm property, largely because the Ruff children realized that she'd forever make those twice-a-month visits to the state hospital keeping an eye on Danny. She lived alone and never went out in the streets or alleys with the cart anymore. The horse was too old, and nobody phoned to have LaVonne do a job. They knew her circumstances had changed. By now, LaVonne's hair was streaked with gray, and she wore it severely back in a bun and looked like some prairie sod-house woman of the 19th century. You might guess that she'd be left alone to live out her years in peace, with whatever private hell she experienced, and wherever she found her heavens. But you don't know our town if you think that. The kids kept talking about the rumor that LaVonne was really a man dressed up in women's clothing. One night in late spring, a bunch of the graduating seniors, out drinking and celebrating, sneaked through the backyard and walked right into the Ruff kitchen, because nobody, not even widows and old maids, locks their doors. Maybe she knew why they'd come and what they meant to do to her. She did not shriek or run for the telephone. They tried to corner her in the front parlor, but she escaped up the stairs. Yelling like animals, they were hot after her. They thought she was merely fleeing, and she was, in part, but she was also trying to remember where she'd put Theodore's Colt 45. Finally, they pinned her down on a musty bed in a back room and ripped every shred of clothing from her body. She fought so wildly that the young athlete astride her got aroused, a local football hero I shan't name, for he later joined the Marines and died in Vietnam. With his teammates cooperating, as they used to do on the playing fields, he made the full discovery of her womanhood, something no man had ever done before, not even her husband Danny. They saw the deep stain on the bedspread and knew her secret, a different one from what they'd come to find. She writhed free of their grasp in the moment her assailants saw the blood. The pistol lay on the washstand next to the only window with a clear view of the barn door. She grabbed the gun and, naked in the starlight, flung herself through the window, shattering the glass as she flew. Aghast and suddenly sober, they raced downstairs and out the front door, got into their cars and spurted away. They didn't even have the decency to go round back to see what might be done to help her. They just wanted to get away and not be caught. A neighbor heard the crash but couldn't figure out for a long time what had caused it. Then he saw the pale, nude figure on the lawn, slowly moving through the grass, long hair down her back. He'd have gone over at once if he hadn't also noticed that she was entirely naked, her breasts flat and loose. There seemed to be some dark stuff like paint here and there on her body. He figured that whatever she was up to, she wanted to do it alone. She squirmed across the long backyard lawn, hung a while on the picket gate till she worked the latch open, then slumped down again to wiggle through the hollyhocks. It took nearly 20 minutes for her to get to the barn, the horse whinnying and trampling the earth as she came. She reached him at last and somehow managed to pull herself upright in the stall so that she could explain to the horse and to herself what she was about to do, in a voice none of us ever heard give utterance to anything that mattered. You can be sure she spoke. She got very close to his walleye, we know from the wound, and pulled the trigger. Then she shot herself, her left hand clutching the mane, a fistful of sorrel hair. Her head lay near his furry ear as if she'd just stopped speaking. Those who came up after the pistol fired and saw the naked woman sprawled across a horse's body said later that Lady Godiva herself had not been more beautiful. Isn't it just like them to say something like that? Her leg had been broken, the doctor reported. Her leg, not the horse's. You are listening to Classic and Contemporary Short Stories on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm Linda Primavera. The next story is from the same book, Light Timber by Nancy Potter. My Uncle Jude was a throwback, everyone agreed. He would have liked to have been in the mainstream but lost his way. Jude was my mother's brother, only son in the family, which I suppose was part of the problem. My using his first name, by the way, shows no disrespect. He was fond of saying that he was a simple sort, which in some ways was true. He disliked the rain and the calls of doves or pigeons, but he was something of a crepe hanger and liked to read the obituaries or visit the old and nursing homes, and he always teared up when he heard, "Oh, promise me," or "Panis Angelicus." He was my godfather, and until I was about 10, he was my favorite person. His pockets held gifts to be searched for, tin whistles, measuring tape, yo-yos, barrettes, thimbles, once even a compass. For me, he furnished a whole doll's house piece by piece, and before that a tiny farm with wooden animals and barns and fuzzy hedges and little fences. But when I got into junior high, he faded considerably from my life. Oh, he took all of us, mother and dad and the aunts and married uncles, cousins, and my closest friends, to dinner in the Showboat restaurant after my confirmation, and always remembered my birthday with crisp bills, even when I was working after college in New York. He probably made a list of anniversaries and birth dates and had the bills all ready for sending with a carefully addressed card. Of course, the mail was an important part of his life. After the service, he became a mail carrier, and when his legs gave out, he was promoted to sorting in the main post office. Something had happened to his feet, frostbite probably, during the war. For a long time after the war, my mother kept all the letters and cards he had sent her, although they said little. Paris is like any other big town. Can't find anything to eat here. 6 months before I see God's country, yours in haste. Then she must have thrown them out. I was searching yesterday for a scrap of his handwriting, but couldn't find any. Because as an adult, I always found conversation in person or on paper with him awkward, I flinched guiltily when I saw again his black scrawls on the birthday cards and heard his voice sometimes during Thanksgiving or Christmas telephone calls. As with those who are usually only heard in choruses, it's hard to recall his voice, and we made no tapes and took few pictures in my family. Those pictures in which he can be seen only show his head in the back row behind his sisters and their families. There was something about him that even Coda color never caught. His shyness turned then to frown or squint. As a child, I was puzzled by grown-up men in civilian uniforms working as elevator operators, doormen, or train conductors. However, Jude's drab clothes on the job and his weather-darkened mailbag looked very unofficial. When you saw him at a distance, he seemed very much shorter than up close. He stooped, probably a little embarrassed at being 6 foot tall in a house of small women, and his feet bothered him. Like most mail carriers, he was full of cheery patter along his route. "Oh, don't call me Mr. McNamara. Jude's the name, not Judas, Jude, for the patron saint of lost causes. My mother must have thought I needed all the help I could get. A hardship case. Now you take it easy." Another reason Jude stumbled a lot was that he was always looking up, not at the sky, but at trees. Nobody in our family was interested in gardening except to keep grass in its place. And in Jude's generation, they were still congratulating themselves on having escaped being farmers in County Clare. Jude went over on an Aer Lingus flight from Boston to Shannon to help the cousins hay in July. "We're well out of that," he used to tell me. It was trees that he cared about. I don't know why. They try so hard. They give a lot and don't ask much. All that ice and smog and cutting back from the wires and all the different shapes they grow into. You never know. It's all inside telling them but not letting you know until it happens. In passing, he sometimes touched the trunks of the trees along his route. The last of the sickly elms, some old maples, a lanthus coming sturdily along through cracks in the pavement. First he set out a couple of dwarf fruit trees in the back of my grandmother's three-decker. They give a good harvest with little space. Then he put in a row of poplars over my father's protest that they would be dead in 30 years. "Time enough for me," Jude answered. Whenever we saw him reading, it seemed to be about trees, their leaves, and bark and root systems. The few times in recent years that I was in that gloomy parlor for grandmother's birthday parties, Jude would be going out onto the back porch to stare at the branches of the fruit trees. He would make detours on the way to the garage or incinerator to look some more. When I was growing up, the family would have described themselves as close. They saw each other on Sundays and in between called on the phone. They all lived within about a 25-mile radius, and when they said the family, we all knew what they meant. They didn't go in for elaborate explanations, but instead seemed to operate by subtle signaling like flocks of birds. They shared a prejudice against extreme behavior. My mother maintained that you didn't need to wear a miraculous medal to prove you were a Catholic, or display a dozen family photographs on the piano to show that you cared about the subjects. Excesses of religious piety, like putting up Holy Thursday altars at home or Fatima statues in the front yard, were frowned upon. My parents generally regretted the noisy social confusion resulting from the English Mass, the handshakes, the unmelodic hymns, all the strange moving around. They missed the dreamy quiet of the Latin Mass, although neither of them knew Latin. Like Jude's devotion to trees, his religious enthusiasm was a respected mystery to us. We assumed that it took the place of wife and children for him. At 45, after Vatican II, he seemed to have come into his own. He was elected to the newly formed parish council. He passed the basket at any early Sunday Mass, and finally he became a lector. He used to practice the reading up in his room so that he wouldn't stumble over the difficult place names in the epistles. "Your uncle," my father muttered, glancing toward the ceiling from which Jude's voice was solemnly describing Paul's travels. "Your uncle should have been born a church mouse." It was about this time that he began to notice Sister Stanislaus Koska, who was often on reception duty at the parish convent. Probably the first time he rang the bell with a special delivery letter and flustered in her immediate presence, he blundered into his usual chatter about the wet spring good for saplings, mold, and the infield grass at Fenway. It was always safe to talk with nuns about baseball. This was before the modifications began, and she was in the old habit, an impressive 18th-century widow's costume. It was also considered in those days that it was all right to joke a lot with the sisters and even outside of the classroom to call them by familiar nicknames. Of course she was Sister Stash. She had come from a Polish family in another part of the state and was the first religious in generations. Once they got over the shock, they canonized her, driving up to the convent on Sundays in their big Buicks to cart her off with another sister for an expensive dinner in some fancy restaurant. They would dance around her, laughing and smiling. She was their talisman. New babies were brought to sit on her lap. Her nephews made her hand-tooled missile covers at camp. Her father provided styrofoam hampers of kielbasa, and her brother told her frequently how lucky she really was. At the end of the summer of 1967, I came home from waitressing to get ready for another year at college. It was Labor Day, when the big parish fair is always held. It grows bigger every year. They raffle off a new Mercury, which is the central attraction, import through a concessionaire several fairly dull rides on which no one can get hurt, offer free blood pressure tests, provide a different band every night, and serve two sittings of a cheap shore dinner of chowder, clam cakes, and watermelon. And of course, there are the tables of fancy work and white elephants. Jude led me toward the jewelry table behind which Sister Stash was installed. That year, the jewelry was particularly ugly. The table featured bead necklaces, name bracelets, little animals painted on shells, and ceramic pansies. Sister Stash was sitting on a folding chair behind the table, looking out in a dazed, indifferent way. She was in the newly modified habit, which added 10 years and several pounds to all the wearers. It included a mid-calf skirt, high-neck blouse, and a little cotton headscarf. I was not surprised that Jude stopped at the table. He was a compulsive buyer of books of chances and lottery tickets. Never know when our ship will come in. He was a pushover for any Sunday solicitors for causes or kids unloading giant candy bars for Little League or holding canisters for band uniforms. "I want you to pick out some earrings," he said. "Anything you want." He seemed quite nervous. "This is my niece, Molly, Sister Stash. I want her to have something nice. Remember, I told you she's the one up at state. She could become a lawyer some day." I was surprised that he had mentioned me to her at all. We stood uncomfortably in front of the card table, looking at shells awkwardly glued to earrings and seahorses stuck in plastic. I couldn't see one possibility in the whole lot. Looking across into Sister Stash's eyes, I thought she recognized my dilemma, but her expression never revealed. Her face was like a doll's, perfect without being beautiful or memorable. Because her lips were often parted, she looked about to say something. The white blouse and kerchief gave her the look of a sturdy peasant in a costume movie. Jude must have had a beer or two at the Rathskeller tent. They were featuring a German theme at the fair that year. He had a low tolerance for drinking. It made him silly and sleepy. He held up a pair of tiered, sparkling earrings to his own earlobes against his large, flushed face. Sister Stash looked confused and was rather abrupt. "You'll take these?" "What a saleswoman you make," he said. "Come on, Molly, don't you want to buy some Christmas gifts for your chums?" I asked Sister Stash what grade she would be teaching next year, and she said, "Who knows? They never tell you until the day school opens. I guess it doesn't matter." "They'll be lucky kids, whichever ones they are," Jude said, and as we walked away he was still holding the earrings, which he fortunately forgot to give me. "What a wonderful spirit she has," he said. A few weeks before the Christmas after that fair, I had a strange telephone call from my mother. She always waited for cheaper rates, and she never called in the morning. I thought that grandmother had gone when I heard her strained voice. "No, it's worse than that, if you can imagine." "What?" I asked, shivering in the ugly dorm phone booth, trying to keep my voice calm. "It's Jude. He wants to get married to Sister Stash. That is, Rose, whatever her real name is." "Maybe he's in love," I said. "How could he be? Jude? Why, he hardly knows her. She's coming out, though." "Well, that's lucky. They couldn't very well live in the convent," I said. "Don't be smart," she said. "There's nothing funny about this. I wanted you to know that you can plan to go somewhere else for Christmas if you want. It's going to be terrible around here. The embarrassment, the bad luck. What did we ever do to deserve this?" "I don't see that he's done anything wrong," I said. "He's a good man, a lot better than most." "That's just it. Your father says it's like a cow that gives a fine pail of milk and then kicks it over." It was impossible to discover where my father picked up those comparisons. "Where is Jude now?" I asked. "Shouldn't I congratulate him?" "He's upstairs fixing his breakfast," my mother replied. Well, he won't have to do that anymore, I said. My mother ignored that comment. Jude's making his own breakfast had always seemed the ultimate loneliness. He was meticulous about the details, setting out the coffee cup and plate the night before with the knife and spoon and one paper napkin. About the wedding, we were torn between confusion and curiosity. By now, I was so absorbed in college life that what I was seeing at home was distanced as in a movie. So many religious were then leaving the orders that Sister Stash's request for release from vows was processed rapidly, and the simple document arrived back from Rome in no time. Rose, we had to remember to call her that, was waiting at the mother house to be fetched. On the first day of my Christmas vacation, my mother and I, somewhat like chaperones, drove up there with Jude. I didn't see them greet each other. He rang the doorbell and went inside, returning quickly with her in a small suitcase. She may have gone shopping earlier, or perhaps they gave her the navy blue polo coat, which was too long and a few sizes too big. We had the car radio on and sang along with the Christmas carols, then stopped at a Friendly's for hamburgers and shakes. Rose pushed the food around her plate while Jude ate heartily. She stayed in my parents' apartment since her family was still so scandalized by her coming out that no one among them could be mustered to communicate, let alone participate in the ceremony. Therefore, there was no point in delaying the wedding, and the holidays ran together in confusion. Jude was a changed man, laughing, touching things, waving his hands in the air, but I never saw him embrace her. Rose and I went shopping once before the wedding. Used to the company of women, she talked more with me than in the house with Jude. She went busily through the crowded shopping mall, feeling fabrics, picking over the bargain tables, and finally selected a marked-down street-length blue wool dress that she could wear later. Although the order had become much less strict, she had 10 years to make up for. I wasn't used to seeing her in bright colors, and she tended to buy everything a size too large. Since they were taking a package tour to Acapulco, she also bought a bathing suit. The whole idea of their honeymoon seemed indiscreet to me. We tried to make the wedding as festive as we could, but it was clear that we were all on edge, bumping into each other and talking too loudly. They were married at a 10 o'clock mass on the day after Christmas. Our timing was off. The ceremony was very brief, and we got to the Mona Lisa Lounge too early. They hadn't set up the tables for lunch, and even the bar wasn't open. Rose observed that this wedding had been a good deal shorter than the other one. That was the only funny thing anyone said. After the drinks and food arrived, matters improved. Then, as so often, my father surprised me. He had stood up for Jude, and as best man was expected to offer the toast. He must have searched through the biblical glossary for the one he gave. He made some reference to Jude as a tree planter, and then he quoted Isaiah, "As the days of a tree are the days of my people, and the works of their hands shall be of long continuance." My father had a lovely voice, and he spoke with real conviction as if making up for years of slighting Jude. The tension broke for a while, and we noisily got into our cars and congregated on the observation deck of our shabby little state airport to see them off. Rose was wearing her polo coat, to which she had pinned the orchid corsage. She seemed not to walk with Jude as much as to run ahead with a bunch of strangers. He stood behind, waving repeatedly at us. Then we drove back home, uneasy and not wanting to separate. Over the old fashions, my father said that it was the oddest Christmas he had ever wanted to spend. Family gatherings after that time maintained the tension. It took some getting used to, thinking of Jude as married, and he was busy creating a cult for her. She was often absent in her sewing room or shopping when he talked about her. When she did appear, she was as elusive as a breeze. She looked different from the rest of us. We are swarthy Irish, like big shade trees. She was light and supple as a birch, the leaves glistening like ghosts. Jude was totally absorbed by her, plying her continually with questions. Should he wear the black necktie with the green suit? Should they cash in the matured saving bonds? Should they take up line dancing? Could she explain existentialism simply to him? All the while, she seemed to be looking sideways to escape his scrutiny, or perhaps she was dreaming with her eyes open. Her answers were minimal. Once he said to me, "She's so quiet, she scares me. I don't know what's going on in her mind. Remembering, I suppose, she's been through so much." And sometimes when we were all sitting around after dinner, he would try to lead her into the conversation. "Rose, tell them about almost setting the novitiate on fire when you were scrambling eggs after lights out." She would protest, "It wasn't that funny. They wouldn't be interested." and quite lamely she would begin the story. We felt constrained to laugh far more than it deserved, which may have convinced Jude that she was witty. But anyone looking carefully at her impassive face and twisting hands knew otherwise. Occasionally she would interrupt the stories with a sigh, as if the weight of the words troubled her tongue, and Jude would finish them. They had been married 2 years when she left him, apparently not for anyone else, simply for herself. Not that we ever really got the whole story. Maybe there was no one episode, probably no great disagreement, and there was no divorce. So quiet were they that the rest of the family did not discover the loss until she'd been gone a few days. It was certainly inconceivable that they would have shouted or cried out or thrown things at each other or slammed doors. She may have figured out finally that he married her for what she represented, or he thought she represented. To everyone but Jude, her departure caused little dislocation. They had continued to live in the top-floor apartment of my grandmother's three-decker. So there Jude stayed among all his things, having, one might say, the run of the house, looking in on the other relatives and out at his trees. "You were right to plant those poplars. They'll be here long after us, that's for sure," my father repeatedly told him. My cousins and I were busy with our lives, falling in and out of love, marrying and unmarrying, preferring to believe that all of our old life was waiting for us, back there, capable of being taken up, though we seldom tested it. Jude's was the first death in the family I remember. He was rushed to the hospital by his buddies when he slumped over the sorting desk one afternoon and then suffered two massive coronaries, almost too grand an ailment for his modesty. Until then, our family had escaped death and summoned with no preparation. We all stood around Grady's funeral home in unfamiliar dark clothes, wrong for the season. It was July and humid. While gardens were heavy with zinnias and marigolds, mid-July is not a good time for floral sprays. Too late for roses and carnations, too early for mums. Over the whir of the air conditioner, we tried to cheer each other up, to get used to the circumstance. We had not realized that our ceremonies had always been happy, weddings, graduations, christenings. I suppose Jude had attended a lot of wakes and funerals. He would have been in his element. What struck me all over again is how reduced so much of modern living is. Not just the fancy quality of life about which my erudite friends worry about, but the simple routines that people like Jude hanker for. For instance, wakes aren't what they used to be, or parades, or family picnics, or Sunday dinner. Maybe they never were what they were supposed to be. Even summers aren't as good anymore. Naturally, we were all thinking about Rose, who now lives on the West Coast under mysterious circumstances in something like a commune. There was a payphone in the place and all sorts of background noises, children, shouts, and barking dogs, according to my cousin, who was given the responsibility of informing her of Jude's death without encouraging her to attend the funeral. There had been no danger of that. She expressed sympathy to everyone, thanked him for calling, and said goodbye. "Can you imagine?" my mother said. "She didn't even send a flower. Ashamed, I suppose." "Light timber," my father said in an uncontrolled voice. He was more shaken than any of us, perhaps because he was close to Jude in age. I had never seen him cry before, and great untidy tears rained over his face. That girl was light timber. And that story was Light Timber by Nancy Potter from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. The next story is also from the Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. Sand by W.S. Merwin. An ant was born in an hourglass. Before it hatched out, there was nothing to notice. And who would have looked? Who would have suspected that one instant in each measure of time was an egg? And after the ant had emerged, it was too late to ask whether the birth was a mistake. Anyway, there was no one to ask, except those nameless hosts, his brothers, at once much older and much younger than he was, who nudged and ground past him, rustling toward the neck of the glass, and fell, and lay blind, deaf, and dreamless in the mountain made of each other, and would never hatch, though the mountain itself turned over again and again and sent them smoking down from its tip like souls into time. Besides, it never occurred to him that there was a question to ask. He did not know that things ever had been or ever could be any different, and whatever capacity for speech he may have been born with slept on inside him like a grain of sand. There was nothing to eat. But he had never been told about hunger, and ants, particularly those of his species, can subsist for long periods, sometimes for generations, without consuming other life of any kind. The same was true of thirst, dry though that place surely was, made of nothing but those rocks, his family. Whatever discomfort he may have become aware of, arising from either hunger or thirst, seemed to him to be like something that we would no doubt call a memory, returning inexplicably to trouble him in a new life, and certain to fade. It stirred in him like some ghost from his days as a grain of sand, but he could not remember what use it had been to him then, and he would hold it to him and save it for a while, as though there was a danger of losing it. He would hold it, trying to understand it, not knowing that it was pain. Something of that kind was true also of breathing. He was breathing, but he knew nothing of breath. What, after all, reached him through the glass? The light. The darkness. Sounds. Gravity. The desire to climb. What reached the grains of sand? Light. Darkness. Vibrations. Gravity. No one knows what else. His brothers tried to crush him. He tried to count them. He could see that they were not infinite, but he could never start at the beginning. He would count them as the edge passed him faster and faster. He had no names for numbers, but he tried to count the brothers even so, as he was borne along with them, as he climbed on their shoulders, as he swam on their heads, falling with them. He tried to count them as they fell on him and rolled after him to the foot of the next mountain, to the glass. He would start to the top again at once, trying to count them as they slipped under his feet. He would climb, counting, till the mountain turned over, and then he would begin again. Each time the mountain flowed out from under him, he delayed the falling for an instant, and a measure of time paused while he clung to the neck of the glass, climbing on sand. Then everything went on just the same. No one had told him about time. He did not know why he was trying to count. He did not know what a number, a final sum, would tell him, what use it would be to him, what he would call it, where he would put it. He did not know that they were not his real brothers. He thought he was a grain of sand. He did not know that he was alone. And that story was Sand by W.S. Merwin from The Treasury of American Short Stories, edited by Nancy Sullivan. And that's the end of our classic and contemporary short stories for today. If you miss a program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org. Click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left-click on On-Demand Podcasts. You can also listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device. I'm Linda Primavera, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thanks for joining me, and bye for now.